We'll try this.
The recording level.
Yeah.
Last time. Okay. So, welcome back. I hope everyone had a nice Pesach. And we're back with more Why Do We Do That? So, I wanted to talk about Shlissel Challah this week, because last week, I mean, you know, it's not in time for you to be ready for doing it. We're like, you know, 51 weeks off. But it was last week, but it is a very interesting custom, and it's one which is becoming more popular all the time. People who didn't do it before or didn't do it a generation ago, a lot more people are starting to do this minhag. So what I wanted to look at was, number one, what is this? What is the reason for it? And also, a few years ago, someone wrote an article which sparked a lot of controversy about this practice. So and claimed that it may be really seriously problematic. So I wanted to look at that, and we'll sort of see how we can maybe react to it or respond to the arguments that are there. So Shlissel Challah. What is Shlissel Challah? So I gave you three pictures here, which are examples. We'll see in some of the sources different variations of what the minhag is, but it has something to do with the Shabbos after Pesach. You take a key. Your challah is key themed. Either the challah is shaped like a key, so that's, I have a picture here. Some people shape the challah like a key. Some people bake a key onto the top of the challah. That's at the left here. And on the right is a picture of a challah with a key inside. Also known as a picture of a challah. There may not be a key in there, there probably isn't. But that's what some people do. Some people bake it on top, some people bake it inside. Some people also describe they would just take sesame seeds or poppy seeds or something and make the shape of a key on the top of the challah. That's also something people do. But it has something to do with involving a key in your challah on the Shabbos right after Pesach. And as I mentioned, this is something that has become much more widespread. As we see historically, I think it was basically a Hasidic kind of minhag. And, you know, now it's sort of proliferated. My family usually, I mean, sometimes I think they did start doing it at some point. My wife's family has done it for a long time. Other people, I don't know what your experience is. If you started doing it, sounds like you did start, maybe a little bit have the experience.
Yeah,
it's generally an Ashkenazi thing. I mean, I have not heard actually at all, or found sources of Sfardim doing this. And we'll see that the historical sources are basically Hasidic Ashkenazi sources for the basis of this. The question is, what I want to deal with first, because it'll give us the background for sort of the history part of it at the end, is what is the reason for this? So if I would throw this out, what's the reason for Shlissel? Why do we do this?
Supposed to bring you to Parnassa.
Parnassa, right. It's a, so that's what, if you ask...
I don't know.
That's a good question. It's keys to something. If you ask people on the... I don't know if there's a street, but if you ask people on the street, they might tell you that it's a segula for Parnassa. If you make these things, if you bake a key in the bread, or if you make the thing in the shape of a key, the chal in the shape of a key, then it's supposed to give you Parnassa. And I've heard people have, you know, ask interesting, I've seen from the internet, interesting kinds of questions. How do I do it? You know, do I put in my business key or do I put in my house key? Does it depend where I need the money more? And what if I want a new car? Should I put in my car key? And maybe you should put in all the keys. Can you put in more than one key? People ask, but that's usually the idea on the street is that it's a segula for Parnassa. And we'll see as we go into some of the actual sources which describe why this is done, it's not totally clear that this was a segula. We'll have to talk about it. That's going to be part of the discussion today. We've seen a couple of examples in the past, you know, as we've been discussing things, of things which are segulas. You do something and it's supposed to have some sort of influence and change the world around you. We talked about that, for example, with the red string. You put on a red string and it's supposed to protect you from diseases, protect women in childbirth, protect babies. And so this, you know, the popular understanding is this is something along those lines. You put the key in, you have the key there, and it will increase your parnassa. So we'll have to see what the reasons for the practice are. And there's sort of a twofold question. One is, what is the story with the key? Why are we putting a key into the challah, and what is this about? And the second part of the question is, why are we doing this specifically right after, in the Shabbos after Pesach? What is the connection between this and Pesach? Now, one possibility We have a few here which we'll go through. One possibility is that there is a clear connection, at least, I mean, a very strong connection in the Mishnah between Pesach and Parnassa. Pesach and the concept of, you know, having your whatever amount of sustenance you're going to have meted out for you at Pesach time, sort of.
Isn't it Rosh Hashanah? That's what you pray for in Rosh Hashanah.
Ah, so that's perfect question. That's exactly the question we're going to ask in a second.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the, and we look in source number one. This is a Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, the second Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, and here we say the Mishnah says that there are four times in the year when judgment happens, when God sits in judgment over different things. There are different things in all the four times of the year. The Pesach, the Arba Prakim Ha'olam Nidon, the world is judged during four different points. The Pesach Al Hatvua, on Pesach, the world is judged for grain. Batseret Al Perota Ilan, on Shavuot, you get judged for fruits, for trees, fruit from trees. Rosh Hashanah Kol Ba'i Olam Ovrin Lefanav Kivnei Maron, on Rosh Hashanah, every single person in the world passes in front of God like sheep. As it were, as it we say in Tehillim, Hayotzer Yachad Libam Hemevin Al Kol Maaseihem. God created all of their hearts together. He's the one that created everyone's heart, everyone's mind, and He understands all of their actions. So there's a day in the year when God takes into account all of our activities for the past year. Ubechag Nidon Al Hamayim, and on Sukkot we're judged for water. So that's what you have, the four times of the year. One of, on Pesach, it's for grain. On Shavuot, it's for fruit. On Sukkot, it's for water. And on Rosh Hashanah, every single person gets judged. So the question that comes up here is, it seems to be redundant. If Rosh Hashanah is the day that everybody is judged for all the things that happen in their life, and there's a decision made about what your following year is going to be like, then what exactly happens on these other days? What is the purpose of these other days? Presumably, if on Rosh Hashanah, everyone's parnassa for the whole year, which includes how much grain they're going to have, how much water they're going to have, how much everything they're going to have, has already been decided, then collectively it's all done. What exactly is happening at these other times of the year? And that's the question that many people ask here. I quoted one answer, which is in source number two, the Tosfot Yom Tov. He's actually quoting from an earlier source, from the Ran, and he mentions this question. He says, "Kvekashali, kevan she'adam nidon b'Rosh Hashanah." It's difficult. It's confused. Once a person is judged on Rosh Hashanah, vaday al kol ha'me'orot shelanu danin otav. So then, certainly, he's already judged for all kol ha'me'orot shelo. He's judged for all the events, everything that's coming for the following year. Al tovato v'peratav v'shar iskav. He's judged for his grain, for his fruit, for everything else that he's involved with. V'kevan sheken ha'kol nidon b'Rosh Hashanah. So if that's true, all of the judgment happens on Rosh Hashanah, and what exactly do we need these other 3 days for? So he says that the answer is as follows. Really what happens is, during these three periods, during Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, there's a general judgment. How much grain is going to exist in the world in the following year? How much water is going to be available for everyone in the world during the following year? How much fruit? And on Rosh Hashanah, there's a personal judgment for each individual of how much of that overall allotment is going to go to person X and person Y and person Z. So that's how he answers this. Nichali shegimel dvarim nidonin lechol haolam b'shloshes manim elu hashnuin b'mishnatenu. These three things are judged for the whole world during the three times that are mentioned in the Mishnah. Aval b'Rosh Hashanah kol bai olam ovrin lefanav echad echad v'gozrim alav chalko midvarim halalu. But during Rosh Hashanah, everyone in the world comes in front of God, and it's decreed what exactly each person's portion is going to be from this overall pie of all the grain that's coming down into the world. There are other ways that people answer this question, which limit sort of the effect of what exactly is going on during these three different times in the year, the non-Rosh Hashanah times. But according to this answer, according to other answers also, the Pesach is a significant moment in terms of Parnassa. This is what people want to point out. Pesach is a significant moment in terms of deciding how much grain, how much produce is going to exist in the world for the coming year. Yeah.
It also seems that Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot are for things that we have no control of. I mean, we're at the mercy of Hashem, and it's as a gift we get. Mm-hmm. But Rosh Hashanah, we actually have some part to play. You know, there is, you made tshuva, so we have an opportunity to seek repentance, you know, make up for.
Right. There's certainly,
so,
you know.
But that is only when that's in our control.
That's true. This is an interesting point. Certainly, there's much more engagement on our part, and it's certainly much more demarcated as a Rosh Hashanah kind of day, as a judgment kind of day on Rosh Hashanah than it is on any of these other days. That's true. So this is, I heard this suggested by somebody. This was actually, I think, Rabbi Arya Leibovitz from YU. He suggested maybe this is part of the connection. There seems to be here a strong connection between Pesach and Parnassa. This doesn't explain why we're involved with keys and why it's only on Pesach and not the other regalim and so on. So we'll see some of the other answers explain that. But
Because we have to spend so much money for Pesach.
So that's the time when you really need it.
Really, after that, you're like praying that you're going to have more money to come the rest of the year.
I'm not sure they had that problem back then, though. I don't know.
But that's certainly... I mean, even in earlier times, there is a concept of, you know, having everything that you need for Yantin. There is a notion of being ready or having to get extra food, extra things for Yantin. That's true.
Even in Estelle, they had it probably getting... Or they just... Maybe koshered everything.
But,
maybe
yeah, but the thing is also, if you're doing it by how many days of Yom Tov you have, you actually, Sukkot, you also have, in the diaspora, you have four, just like Pesach.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, it seems like the wine, the quantity, to Maggie's point, maybe it's the overall quantity that you need to have just to be able to celebrate these holidays properly.
It's possible that that's true. So this is something that someone suggested. What I want to, and certainly it's true that there's a correlation between Pesach and Parnassa. What I wanted to look at also is to look at a little bit more of a historical view. Where did we find this in the first place?
Sorry to interrupt, one more point.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, you see that everything is around Rosh Hashanah. So Pesach, Shavuot, then Rosh Hashanah, because it's and then you have Sukkot. It's almost like those three holidays, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, are the pilgrimage holidays.
Yeah.
So in other words, there may be some allusion to the fact that, you know, it's so important for you to congregate. But the true element, the only really time where you're actually praying for yourself, for the good things that have come to you, are actually Rosh Hashanah. Because the other times you're doing it for something else. It's the offering that you're giving. It's the money that you have to give. And so maybe Rosh Hashanah is basically the only one that is like, I'm not giving, I'm getting.
Right. There are certainly views that look at that. Sometimes we look at the holidays, divide them into two kind of systems. You have the regalim system, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, which are along agricultural lines. Then you have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, which comes. But there are other you know, sort of systems where they look at it as one. You know, continuity, thematically, from Pesach to Shavuot to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and then to Sukkot, so for sure. So I wanted to look back historically, where are the earliest indications, where are the earliest sources that we have any mention of something like dealing with keys and challah and the week after Shabbos, after Pesach, what is that about? The earliest source that I found was in this source, in source number 3. This is a quotation from, he didn't write the book, but it's a quotation from Rabbi Pinchas of Koritz, who you have his dates there, 1728 to 1790. Rabbi Pinchas Mikoritz was a student of the Baal Shem Tov. This is, you know, second generation Hasidim, and he's quoting, I didn't actually include it properly, because he talks about other things they used to do. This is a description of what they used to do on the Shabbat which followed Pesach. And he says he heard from the Rav, which presumably is talking about the Baal Shem Tov, that one of the things that you do is menakvin hachala b'mafteach, remez detarin p'tichin ad Pesach sheni. So here actually you have a key and you have the challah, but it's none of the things that most people do today. You don't bake it on top, you don't bake it inside, it's not shaped like a key. They would take keys and poke them into the challah, like you're trying to open the challah with a key.
That's a Hasidic thought. You know, you have your kippah, according to the Hasidic thought, and they look at it like an orange peel, and your job is to actually pierce
it. You've got to get inside. Yeah. So certainly there's other connotations in terms of Hasidic
there. Can I ask one other question? I know I'm
go ahead. That's fine.
But, you know, the Shabbat before Pesach is Shabbat HaGadol, and this being, you know, called whatever, Shabbat Shlissel, if you want to make it a mockery or you want to joke about it, but it's almost the same kind of concept of, you know, for the Seder Tumei Teshuva, the door is open, on Rosh Hashanah, it closes on Kippur. So it's almost like, you know, the door opens on Shabbat HaGadol.
Yeah.
You have Pesach, then it's basically a span of, what I guess, 12, 13 days perhaps. And then you actually close it it's almost like a completed type of thing, like Rosh Hashanah.
That's
and
very good.
Right. So this is exactly what he's getting at here. The timing is not exactly the same as what you mentioned, but he says there's a remez, so they would sort of stab the challah with keys. Remez the tar in p'tichin. It's a symbol. It's a reminder of the fact that the gates are open ad Pesach Sheni, until Pesach Sheni, which is a month later. Right, we have Pesach Rishon in Nisan, and then the Torah prescribes for people that were tameh, they're impure, they were too far away from Yerushalayim during Pesach Rishon, you can bring a Korban Pesach a month later. So the idea here is that the gates, whatever exactly the gates are, he's not totally clear here. The gates has something to do with our relationship with God, some kind of closeness, some kind of readiness for this relationship. They're open until Pesach Sheni. Zeshamati me riabno. I heard this from Memory Shudal. I'm not exactly sure who that is. I'm presuming it's one of the sons of the Baal Shem Tov. Befanav, when in front of him, meaning when the Baal Shem Tov was there. Ubekitzer v'lo babir. But he explained it to me in brief. He didn't really explain what this was all about. So this is the earliest sort of mention of this practice. And you see here, it's not what we do today. It's not baking with it inside. And you see, the goal here, and we'll talk about this again at the end, is not a segula. The idea is not that you do this and then you get, in fact, there's nothing to do with Parnassah. It doesn't make any mention to Parnassah at all. The idea is that this is symbolic. We're trying to remember that we've been through Pesach, we had this tremendous spiritually uplifting time, hopefully, we recognize this closeness of relationship that exists between us and God, and we're just trying to remind ourselves that is still available. Maybe you don't feel it once you leave Pesach and you're in the normal week, but on Shabbos we have an opportunity to try and reattach to this kind of feeling. Just to remind us that this is open. Why don't we do this every week until Pesach Sheni? I don't know. Maybe. You can do it. So you just stab.
You know, it says in the Gemara, you shouldn't put money in your mouth, right?
Obviously, yeah.
Because it's handled by everything. The other thing is, it makes sense why you'd poke a hole but not put it in your bread, because just like you're not supposed to put money in your mouth, a key has been touching people's hands, it's been...
Yeah, hygienically it makes sense. I also think the idea here is we're trying to open up the gate.
Yeah.
I have my key,
yeah.
I'm opening up the gate, but the gate is for some reason the challah, which is not clear.
Why a challah?
I don't know. He does say before this that they used to make kind of matzahs. I don't know if they were real. It says ke'ein matzah. I guess they were sort of flatbread, but maybe not. Strictly speaking, non-chametz matzahs, which they would also eat to remind them about Pesach Sheni, that it was coming up. That we don't. I think people actually ate some matzah this week by accident. Not by accident, but whatever. Incidentally. But most people don't want to do that at this point. Okay, so that's one possible reason. This is the earliest source we have. 1700s probably stretches back a little bit earlier than that if it's coming from the Baal Shem Tov, which, puts it, it's not old. It's not old by sort of Jewish standards in general, but it's an old Hasidic minhag. It's about as old as a Hasidic minhag can get because it originated with the Baal Shem Tov,
which
started.
It may not be a Jewish source either.
Oh, so we're going to get there soon. That's coming. That's a controversy that I mentioned before. So yes, we shall see. So this is one possible reason here. Another possible reason, in the next generation of Hasidic Rebbes, the Apter Rebbe, Rav Avram Yeshua Heschel, who is also the namesake of the other Avram Yeshua Heschel, from JTS. I think he was his great-great-grandfather, so he was a descendant of the Apter Rebbe. So he also attempts to explain this. He gives some explanation. And just as a preface, I have here in Source 4, he's going to use this, a description from Sefer Yehoshua. And basically the description is they came in Sefer Yehoshua, they finally crossed, the Jews crossed into Israel, they crossed the Yarden, they came into Israel, they set up camp there, and then they, we'll see here described, they made Pesach, and after they made Pesach, until this time, since they entered into the desert 40 odd years before, they had been sustained by the man. Right, they're constantly eating man, and this was the time when they flipped over and they stopped eating the man. This is described in Tanakh. This was what we see here. Vayomer Hashem al Yehoshua, Hayom galoti et chirpat Mitzrayim aleichem. Hashem tells Yehoshua, I've rolled away, I've removed the disgrace of Egypt from you. Vayikrashim amakomahu Gilgal ad Hayom azeh. So that the place where they were was called Gilgal, which is a critical central location for many things that happened in Tanakh after this. Vayachanu bnei Yisrael beGilgal vayasu at Pesach ba'arba'asar yom lechodesh be'erev ba'arvot Yericho. They made a korban Pesach. Before this, it describes that they did Mila for all of the men, because when they were traveling in the desert, they couldn't do Mila. You're not supposed to do it when you're traveling. And so this was probably the first Korban Pesach they'd done in a very long time, because you're not allowed to have a Korban Pesach if you or anyone in your household does not have a Mila. Vayochlu, so they did this Korban Pesach, and then afterwards, Vayochlu me'avur ha'aretz mimacharat ha'pesach matzot v'kalui be'etzem hayom hazeh. The day after they brought the Korban Pesach, they started to eat from the produce of the land. They stopped eating man, they started to eat from the produce of the land. Vayishbo taman mimacharat be'ochlam me'avur ha'aretz. As soon as they started to eat from the land, the produce itself, the man stopped falling. V'lo haya od libnei Yisrael man, vayochlu mitvuat eretz kna'an b'shanahi. So what the Apter Rav is going to point out is there's a correlation between right after Pesach, or Pesach time, and a time when Bnei Yisrael moved from eating man for all of these years that they were eating man in the desert to eating from the produce of the land, eating from the produce in Israel. And that is what generated this need for Parnassah, because when the man is coming, it's coming on a consistent basis. You're not so worried about where your next meal is going to come from because you know that the man is coming. Suddenly, when you have to sort of sustain yourself, it's still God doing it, obviously, but when you have to sustain yourself, you end up in a situation where you feel this need to pray for Parnassa. And this is going to be the first reason that he gives for the Shlissel Challah, for having this challah right after Pesach, which involves, and this is our first reference to it, as having something to do with Parnassa. So here he's going to say this. Haminhag hu miyamim kadmonim, Linkov etachalot b'Shabbat shel achar Pesach b'maftechot. The old minhag from previous generations is to poke, again, he says, to poke holes into the challahs on the Shabbos after Pesach with keys. V'nasa challah tzurat mafteach. V'nasa al ha-challah, sorry, tzurat mafteach. And this is the first place we see a mention of this other way of doing it, which is that you make some sort of image of a key on top of the challah. U'minhag Yisrael torahu v'tzarech tam. Any minhag of Yisrael like this, which they do, is Torah. It has some sort of real reason, and we have to explain it. Kvar bi'arnu tamim al zeh le'el. We've already explained this before. V'hinei yesh od le'lo milim tam echad al pipshuto. Hinei ba'et hazot k'she'achu Yisrael min haman me'akravat ha'omer ve'elach lo achlu od man min haman k'mo she'amar ha'katuv v'yochlu m'macharat ha'pesach me'avur ha'aretz. So he points to this reason that right after Pesach, or involved in Pesach, there was a transition from the man that they were eating in the desert to eating from the food that is in Israel, from the produce of the land. We say this in the Gemara also, that the day after the Pesach, macharata Pesach echol ad hashtalo echol, from after the Pesach they started to eat from the land, before this they didn't. Umaaz hitchilu lechol mitvuat haaretz, v'hayu Yisrael tzrichin leparnasa, ki ad ata hayalahem haman. So then they started to eat from the land, and that's when they needed this concept of parnasa, because until this point, they had the man. V'zot yadua, so okay, fine, that explains why there's parnasa. What's this business with the key? Why is there a key involved here? V'zot yadua, shelakol davar yesh shar, kamo she'anachnu mitpalalin, shiyiftach lanu Hashem yitbarach sharei parnasa. And it's known that everything has a gate. We talk about gates. So, for example, when we're talking about tefillah, we talk about the gates of tefillah. So everything, you know, that we sort of approach God for it. Oh yeah, like for example, there's a shul called Shari Tefillah. That's a good point. So there's a shul called Shari. Yeah, fine. So we talk about the gates of tefillah. Everything has gates, and the gates obviously have a key. And we're praying, we want God to open these gates for us. Mitpalalin, anachnu mitpalalin, sheiftach lanu Hashem yitbarach sharei parnasa. We want God to open the gates of parnasa. Umizen ishtar bev haminhag liyot osin surat mafteach al hachalot l'rameiz sheiftach lanu Hashem yitbarach sharei parnasa. That's the idea, that we make a key, or we make the form of a key on top of challah, or we poke the challah key into the challah, so God will open the gates of parnasa.
Yes. I've got a really weird theory.
Okay.
First time in the Torah, do you remember when it, the first time in the Torah when it's mentioned that a bunch of Jews went to a gate to buy bread? So it's when Yosef, his brothers came. Remember,
okay.
Yaakov sends them to make sure, you know, they had enough bread at home. But apparently to show that they were suffering like everybody else, the rush, he says, go to Egypt, buy bread. So they had to pass in the gate. And at that moment in time, of course, the Paro's courtiers and spies saw that these group of men came, they were powerful, strong. But it marked the beginning of their slavery. And just like, you know, after Pesach, we have these 40, we have to remind ourselves that we are free. We're not going back into slavery, that we make this idea of a gate with grain, because that's the attachment to Yosef. We have to remind ourselves that, no, we're not going to fall into that trap that we fell into Egypt. We're going to, you know, this key is symbolic of those gates that we can go through the gate, but we're not going to go back into slavery.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's certainly. Especially when you start with a Hasidic minhag, like, it's really open to any possible way of looking at it, and it's very nice.
Well,
what?
But they don't do like a bracha on any of this.
There's no bracha. There's no.
There's no
anything. There's no statement. There's no anything. You just have it there, and that's it. I don't know if some people, I think, you know, I saw circulating online, people made special tefillahs and things you should say before you eat the shlissel challah, and when you make the shlissel challah, and when you take the challah, if you make enough of it to take challah, it's a whole thing. But really, it's all stuff that people made up along the way.
I think we should recall that they give it a Yiddish name, right? They don't give it a Hebrew name. So when you see things that are not with a Hebrew name, you really question, really, is there a Jewish origin?
I mean, it's because it's Hasidish, right?
See, yeah, I know.
They call it shlisa. In Israel, it's called chalat mafteach.
Yeah.
Chalat mafteach.
That's the key
challah.
But it was only known that after.
Like, I was talking to my chavrusa here, who's Israeli, and I said, I'm talking about shlisel challah tonight, and he said, what is that? He didn't know what it was. But then I said chalat mafteach. Oh, of course. And we do it this way, and we do it that way. One thing which I failed to put on the sheet, unfortunately, in terms of this notion of a key and a mafteach, is that there is a gemara that says that there are several things which God holds the keys to. He doesn't give us the keys himself. He holds the keys. One of them is rain. One of them is childbirth. There's another one, which I don't recall what the third one is there, but it's not Parnassa. And then there's a Medrash version of that Gemara where it swaps out, I think, rain for Parnassa. So there's this concept of a Mafteach Shel Parnassa. Mm. That's a thing. It exists. It's in the Medrash, the Medrash Rabbah, I think Parshas Tzav, if I'm not mistaken. And there, the Medrash says that God has this key to the Parnassa, and he holds on to it. He doesn't give it to us. We don't have the ability to access it. So that also could play into this notion that there is a concept of Mafteach Shel Parnassa, the symbol of a key of Parnassa, and we're praying to God to help us with the, you know, use the key of Parnassa and to help us at this time. That's one reason that the Apta Rav mentions. The other reason he mentions is in terms of Svira to Omer. Why are we doing this now? Now we're in the transitional period of Svira to Omer. And he says that perhaps, Ki be'etahu sofrimanu Svira shiva shavuot, we count the Svira, and according to Kabbalah, they're correlated with the 50 gates of wisdom that we're trying to pass through in terms of Sfira to Omer. V'anachnu holchi mishar l'shar, u'lekol shar yesh mafteach, v'zeo she'osin tzurat mafteach. Because we go from gate to gate, every day is a new gate, we go to another gate, each gate has a key, and therefore we have keys to the gates. And there's like a proliferation of different explanations along these lines.
Isn't sometimes tzaddikim, aren't they sometimes referred to as sfarim as well? Sfarim, like I was listening to this.
Tzaddik is like a Sefer Torah, like a living Sefer Torah, things like that.
It's also sphere, so I wonder if it's like this idea of you're opening the access to the wisdom of the tzaddikim. I don't know.
Maybe, something like
similar,
that.
The word sphere is also used to count, obviously. I mean,
right.
That's what it is.
So there, There's lots of different explanations. There's other proofs from Shira Shirim, Pitchili. There's a description there of the beloved, which is God in that case, coming to the door and saying, "Open it for me, my beloved, my sister, my dove, whatever." And there, you know, the notion that we're supposed to open a little hole, kichudo shel mechet, like the eye of the needle, and then God will open up a much broader vista in terms of our relationship. Okay, there's all kinds of possible explanations. These are some of the core ones, which you see quoted again and again, because they're the earliest references to this minhag. So what we've seen is, again, that nobody has yet to mention baking a key into a challah, which will become important soon. No one has mentioned that, and what we have is either poking the key into the challah or making sort of an image of a challah, of a key on top of the challah with something. And we have this notion of the gates of our relationship with God remaining open until Pesach Sheni. We have a notion of a need for parnassa specifically at this time of the year. This is when Bnei Israel transitioned from eating man to eating from the produce of the land. We have an idea of Sfirat HaOmer, other possible reasons, and that's more or less the background that we get for the minhag. Now, I want to discuss this idea that a few years ago, it was 2011, someone published this article called The Loaf of Idolatry, by the name of Shlomo Alfasa, and he argued that perhaps actually this practice is based purely in Christian practice. And we're going to see what his argument is. And this article is very influential. If you look at a lot of people that talk about this online, they quote him, and they, you know, a lot of different later articles that talk about this topic quote him, and other people quote him in their shiurim and their discussions about it. So I wanted to look at what he says. I thought about it carefully, and, you know, in my humble opinion, I don't think that he has much of an argument here. We'll see. You can take it at face value, I'll tell you. I brought everything that he writes here about this chunk of the article, not the whole article, obviously, and the source note, the footnotes that he brings. So we'll look at what he says, and then I wanted to look at why this might be a problem and how you can maybe deal with or look at some of the things that he argues about, just because it was fascinating for me. I don't know if hopefully it'll be interesting. So basically what he says is, we'll break down the argument afterwards, is that the baking of a key inside a bread is a non-Jewish custom which has its foundations in, probably should say, Christianity, and Christian and possibly even earlier pagan culture. At least one old Irish source tells how at times when a town was under attack, the men said, "Let our women folk be instructed in the art of baking cakes containing keys." Keys were traditionally manufactured in the form of a cross, the traditional symbol of Christianity, a physical item all Christian commoners would possess in their home. And on Easter, the Christian holiday, which celebrates the idea of Oto Ish rising from the dead, they would bake the symbol of him, the key, which is shaped like a cross, into or onto a rising loaf. This was not only a religious gesture, but the bread was a special holiday treat. Sometimes these breads were wholly formed in the shape of a cross. Sometimes the shape of a cross was made out of dough and applied on top. In the context of historically breaking a key into bread, the key itself intrinsically was a symbol of Christianity and by extension symbolized Otoish rising in the dough. So this is the argument that he makes, that historically, basically you can break it down as follows. Keys used to be shaped like a cross. And Christians would bake the keys into their bread as part of the symbolism for their holiday. There are also indications that he mentions that they would make a cross-shaped marking on the bread, on top of the bread. In one of his footnotes here, in footnote 10, he mentions that people used to score the shape of the cross onto the bread. And there's also practice, which he mentions in footnote 11, I didn't bring the whole thing, he has a bunch of examples, of people baking figurines, little figurines into cupcakes or cakes, and whoever finds it gets a prize, or they have to buy the next cake, depending on where you live. And so the conclusion is, if you put all of this together, that it seems that our practice of baking the keys into the challah is just an extension of this Christian practice of baking keys into their bread, and that could be problematic. Why is that problematic? Just, you know, now that we're talking about it, we're not doing it for the same reasons that they were doing it, obviously, right? We're not doing this as a kind of.
It means you can stretch, you can do something for every holiday that would be similar, that would just, we could just steal from somebody else if this is the case.
Yeah, okay.
And I mean, we could justify doing something for Sukkot, something for Shavuot, something for Hanukkah that takes from idolaters, if you will, And we could justify, you said, because if we do it for Pesach, we could do it for the other holidays.
Yeah, and I mean, and the answer is that we are expressly prohibited. I mean, this is something we discussed about a little bit, again, when we talked about the red string. This is a concern people bring up there also, is that we're not allowed to take on practices which emerged out of idol worship, even if we're not doing them in an avodah zarah and an idol worship kind of way. It's something called darkei emori. It's not really idol worship, because we're not doing it as idol worship. And sometimes even, you know, we take on a practice which even the non-Jews are not doing as idol worship, like, you know, having a rabbit's foot on your keychain or something, whatever the example is, right? Something like that, which has become sort of harmless, maybe superstition, whatever, something like that, and we take it on. Even that could be problematic, certainly when we can trace it directly, as we do now. And this is what's here in Source 7, Ein holchin b'chukot ha'ovdei kochavim. We're not supposed to follow in the ways of the idol worshippers. V'lo yilbash malbush miyuchad lehem, v'lo yigdal tzitzit roshok kmo tzitzit roshem. You shouldn't wear their specific dress. You shouldn't have the same hairstyle. Elei amuvdal mehem b'malbusho b'shar ma'asav. V'chol zeinu aser ela o b'davar shenagu leminhagu lechok. V'ein tam b'davar. So this is a problem in terms of something which non-Jews do as a practice, but we don't know what the reason is. Because we're worried that perhaps this emerged out of the past, out of their, you know, religious beliefs in the past, but it sort of lost its way, and now nobody knows why they're doing it. Perhaps there's residue of some kind of idol worship basis from the past, and so we're not supposed to take it on. So this would be a bona fide example of darkei emori. If it was really true, if Christians baked their keys into bread, and we started baking our keys into bread, as an extension of their practice, and then we piled on whatever explanations we had afterwards, that could be a serious problem in terms of darkei emori. Yeah.
Who did it first?
Okay, so that's a question which has to be asked. The first thing I want to deal with here is, just frankly, you know, people read this article, and then they quote the article, and then it's done. And I got a little bit upset about just in terms of, you know, where is this coming from? If we look at things carefully, I mean, and I looked up all the sources to the best of my ability, we do find that, frankly, I don't think this is based on too much. So if this argument that he just said. We can take this point by point. He quotes at least one, the first point he makes is, keys used to be shaped, which is implied in the argument, is that keys used to be shaped like crosses. I tried... and I'm very happy for somebody to correct me, but I tried to find keys from the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th century, you know, just to find random keys just from that era, and it was very hard to find any that were shaped like crosses. I brought some examples of pictures on the last page. Mm-hmm. There's a 15th century key. This is like a random key. You know, I mean, it's not indicative. And again, I'm not a historian, so I don't know if this is valid historical approach, but I tried to find just any keys which were shaped like crosses. This 15th century one, no, I didn't find any really. In the 17th century, I found one that sort of looked like a cross, but the 16th century one doesn't, unless maybe that's, I don't know. The 17th century keys don't. I couldn't find any keys, basically. People make kitschy keys that look like today, you can buy them. But I didn't find an indication that overly, like every commoner person would have a key in their house shaped like, I didn't find any that looked like that. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's possible. Some of these are a little bit 3D, I think. Like, they're thick. They're not flat like our keys. They would have these, like, intricate designs in them so that it would be hard to open the lock, right?
But it is a stretch to say it looks like a cross.
But I guess, maybe, it could be sort of like that. In any event, okay, it's granted. I'm not denying the fact that there could be some keys that are shaped like that. But the allegation here seems to be everybody had these keys, and so it was obvious that they baked them into the bread. Yeah,
but
that's point number one.
I think you're missing one association.
Okay.
The association is that it's with bread, and all the other cultures do it with bread. So that if we're doing it, since we have no other tradition for doing anything with bread, we're following them.
Okay, so we'll get there. Okay. I hear that. Point number one. Point number two is he claims, and this is the most critical point, I think, here, that Christians used to bake keys into or onto their breads. Like they would take a key like what we do today. The biggest problem is he doesn't cite any proof of that. The only thing he cites as proof is this quote from number 7, footnote number 7, is that there's an old Irish source that says, let our women folk be instructed in the art of baking cakes. That is a quote from this person named Flann O'Brien, who was a newspaper columnist in the 20th century, and they published, called The Best of Miles. The book is a collection of fiction newspaper columns from like the few decades before the book was published, and it's a work of fiction. It's a story about Ireland, where he talks about baking keys into... That's not a story. I mean, again, I'm not a historian, but I'm pretty sure that doesn't count as proof. He does...
They do hot cross buns.
Yeah, okay, so we'll get to the hot cross buns. That's coming. Don't worry. I tried to be as thorough. So he tried to... And he doesn't adduce any other proof. He says that it's a physical item all Christian commoners would possess in their home, and they would bake it into the thing. There's no proof of that. In footnote 10, he brings a proof about... people cutting the shape of a cross into the bread. But there's no actual proof, and I searched, if you try and search on Google for the idea of baking key into bread Christianity, the only source for it is this, or people that quoted this article that I could find. I did not find any basis. I tried to find, we'll see, I have a quote here from like the Handbook of Christian Feasts and whatever. I could not find any source of an idea of baking keys into bread. And I will add that we saw already the original practice was not to bake keys into the bread. The only thing that had anything to do with putting it was when you poke the key into the bread. The earliest makor for this minhag was not to bake it into the bread. So if you're arguing that we're continuing their practice of baking things into bread, the earliest historical sources for our minhag do not involve baking anything into anything. Okay, that's point number two. Point number three is that it is true that that Christians do make breads with crosses on them. That's like a famous thing. I have a picture of hot cross buns. This is a thing which I apparently people know. People heard about it? Have you heard about this before?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a song.
It's a nursery rhyme. Hot cross buns.
I don't know. I'd never heard of this before.
Hot cross buns. Yeah,
yeah, it's I don't know. It's a thing. But I learned chopsticks. I don't know. But anyway.
It's the second thing you
learned. Okay, fine. So that is a thing. That's a famous thing. And he has sources also about cutting the shape. And I have here actually that's an old custom in source number 8. This is from the Handbook of Christian Feasts and Customs. It was a universal custom, and still is in Catholic countries, to mark a new loaf of bread with the sign of the cross before cutting it in order to bless it and thank God for it. And on special occasions, it was imprinted before baking. Fine. Good Friday and other days that they, whatever, all kinds of other days. And I can't remember if it was he or she wrote this, but traces the history back to even 1361 in England. That's an old minhag, for sure. Yeah.
There's one thing that Rabbi Alfasa doesn't bring up. You know, there's a custom among Jews when you go into, you buy a new house, you go into the new house, some Jews do, but most Jews do, you bring in salt and you bring in a loaf of bread.
Okay.
And, you know, there is no Jewish source for that except to say that, you know, it is a sustenance, you need it to survive. And, you know, maybe they're, you know, against him, that idea that we do have some significance of bread.
I mean, if you're talking about symbolic bread, we wrote the book on that. Lechem Hapanim, Matzah, is symbolic bread.
Yeah.
We certainly have the trademark on symbolic bread.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
And we do adore our bread at certain times of the year, like on Rosh Hashanah, you're supposed to have a lot of poppies.
Or a round challah or whatever. Challah. We have stuff about bread. I mean, but even in the Torah, there's mitzvahs make this bread, put it in the temple, in the base of Mikdash, on the Shulchan. Yeah. It's going to be there. It's symbolic of what... that's symbolic bread. Anyway, so it's true that there's this old custom of making the crosses on the bread. But once you cut out all the other stuff, which I couldn't find any sources for, so they have a custom of making the cross on the bread. What relationship does that have with putting a key into a bread? I don't know. It's true it's also around the same time of the year. I will grant that also. The hot cross buns are also made around the holiday
Easter.
That's this time of the year.
Yeah.
And we also do it around Pesach. But I don't see, I fail to see the strong argument there. If you say there's a key, and they used to bake a key which was shaped like a cross into the bread, and we're picking that up, I will accept that. But I didn't find any source for that. So basically, at the end of the day, they have breads where they have a cross on it. It's around this time of year. We have other stuff we do with bread around this time of year. I don't see how that necessarily means that one emerges from the other. And there was somebody who, before me, Rabbi Yair Hoffman, from the Five Towns in New York, who took this article to task for this reason, and along the same lines, not exactly the same, and just said we don't find that there's any source. But if you listen, like, people really quoted this. People have asked Poskim questions about whether you're allowed to do this on the basis of this article. And in my humble opinion, again, I'm not a rabbi, I'm not posik, not anything, but it doesn't seem like, oh, I'm not a historian either, it doesn't seem like there's much correlation there. Okay, so that was the argument that some people make, that perhaps there's a concept here of Darkei Amori. I don't exactly see how that's possible. The other argument that people make is that there's an issue of nichush, which I didn't bring any sources for here, but we could talk about it. Nichush is the notion that you're doing sorcery or magic or something, and that leads to a whole question about the concept of a segula, which we sort of mentioned at the beginning. The idea that I'm going to do something now, which is going to influence the world in some sort of mystical way, spiritual way, and then stuff's going to happen. I'll make my key challah with the key here, and then, you know, God has no choice. It's just going to work out, and Parnassa will pop out over there, and then everything will be great. So that is something which potentially, I mean, a lot of people hold by this, that it's an important thing. There's a concept of segula. And there are other people who say that that's problematic, because we're supposed to, we have a concept of tamim tiyayim Hashem elokecha. You have to be wholesome and faithful with God and not try and do backwards, figure out what's going to happen in the future, try and influence things. You should pray. If you don't, you know, you need parnasa, you can pray to God. That's a good avenue to do things. So if we're going to look at this in the popular view, the popular accepted idea that this is a segula for parnasa, then people have objected to it and said, this is a problem, it's nichush. Yes?
I did a search, I wasn't being rude here, but...
Yeah.
I did a search on Chris, because I remember in my head hearing this.
Yeah, did you find something?
The golden key.
Okay.
It's a very big Christian symbol.
Okay.
And, you know, and so it says a simple gold key with a decorative tooth design is drawn in gold with thin black outlines.
Okay.
And that's traditionally, I mean, I made it big.
Is it put into bread? Does it have something to do with
it
bread?
It does. I didn't know, but that's what the key, that symbol is.
Okay.
That's what the Christian, that's a very strong Christian symbol.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting, and I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I remember hearing, because, you know, you often hear, you know that they have the golden rule, and I remember seeing something about a key to the kingdom of heaven.
Okay.
And I remember, you know.
Okay, I will add the caveat that I'm certainly open to revising this perspective.
No, I'm not denying
but that. And maybe I'll check it out, because I got very involved in this, like,
in that,
research the last couple of days, but certainly, in terms of the article that I found here, I didn't understand the problem. Maybe I'll check it out. The golden key. We did. My daughter came home. We put a key. No, we put a. I didn't. It was before I. You know, we did it on Shabbos. We put a key inside. My daughter came home with a picture of a challah with the key, and she was so excited. We're going to make a shlissel challah. So we made it. And then afterwards, I started thinking about it. I had a discussion about someone with it, and then I said, I have to find out exactly. So the poking of the key, apparently some people still do that. My chavrusa told me today. They do the poking, which seems to be the more original version of this minhag. So coming back to this idea of segula, if you're going to say that it really is a segula, that I'm doing this so that I can create parnasa in some sort of mystical way, then there are those who think it's a problem. I haven't heard from him directly, so I can't totally confirm it, that Rav Herschel Schechter is one of the big poskim in YU. He says this is problematic because it's nichush. Potentially also Darkei Amori, but certainly nichush, and you shouldn't do it for that basis. But as we've seen, I think it's important to note that none of the sources that talk about why we do this say you're putting a key on your table so that you'll become wealthier. They say we're putting a key on the table and it's a symbol. It's a symbol of the fact that God holds the keys of Parnassa. It's a symbol of the fact that these gates are open. It's a symbol of the fact that we're at a time now when we're going from gate to gate in the gates of wisdom or whatever. The same way that matzah is also a symbol. You don't eat the matzah because you think it's going to do some sort of stuff. You eat the matzah because it's a symbol of whatever. I don't want to get involved in what the symbol of matzah is.
Just as we don't like to twist Christian themes to make them Jewish.
Yeah.
We should also not accept Christian things and make them Jewish.
Okay.
Right. So we get mad at Christians
who move it in the other direction.
Who basically will take matzah, that's the body of Jesus, right?
Yeah.
We hate to hear that. We hate to see it.
Right.
But in the same way, we may be doing something that...
It could be. If it's true that this is really based on some sort of older Christian practice, then I'm ready to admit that this is problematic and maybe we should not be doing it. But presuming that it's not, You know, the argument is even in addition, even if it has nothing to do with that, it could be problematic just from the perspective that you're doing this and trying to influence God, so to speak, against his will. God has no choice. He's going to give you parnasa because you put a key in your challah. So,
that's
and then
maybe
some people really hold of this. But all I wanted to point out is in the sources that we saw, it wasn't described that way. It was described as a symbol. And there's an important distinction to be made between a segula, something where you're trying to affect change at the mystical level, and just a simple symbol. It's on the table, so we remember. Don't forget the relationship that we had at Pesach. That level is still available to us until Pesach Sheni. Don't forget, it's still there. Just to remind you.
So how would you look at, you know, you have the hand, you have the chamsa, and you have the eye.
Yeah, so there are lots of segulas, and I don't want to get into a comprehensive discussion about segulas. All I'm saying is that in this case, we can sort of skirt it, because the sources that talk about it don't talk about it as a segula. So that's the wrap-up. We saw shlissel challah, we saw some of the ideas which explain it, we saw some of the concerns in terms of idolatry, and this article, which became famous for people that are into this topic, and how I'm, at least in my humble opinion, it's not totally clear how that argument goes. And also in terms of segula, but I think there it's important if we're going to do this, and I think for myself now, this is what I feel. It's important that if we do it, you should think about it, maybe explain it, whatever, to your family when we do it, to say that, you know, we're doing this because it's a symbol of our, you know, relationship with God. It's a symbol of the fact that God is in control of Parnassa and he can help us and we want him to help us. We're praying to him to help us instead of trying to say that it's a segula. At least in this particular instance, it's not clear that that's the case. Okay.
That's great.
Well, that was excellent.
Oh, yeah, great.
Very nice.